quickly say, I don't know how much good you're going to do here, but you've got more press and more media than any meeting we've had on economic matters since the Great Depression. I haven't seen this many microphones since I conceded. I want to compliment you. I don't know whether they're expecting something unusual or not, but maybe it's the fact that so many wonderful people are in this audience. And I do want to thank the media for their interest and for their willingness to take some time and some of their resources to convey a message of national concern to this republic of ours. I have been serving as chairman of the Joint Economic Committee. We've had what I consider to be reasonably good coverage of the hearings before that committee, but there have been witnesses before us. I see my old friend Leon Kaiserling here, just to mention one, who had talked so much good sense that has stayed only within the committee room that it sometimes makes me really quite ill. So much needs to be understood. So much needs to be said. We have a job of national education about economics in this country. And until we can get people's attention and get them to understand what's happening in our economy, we're not going to achieve the goals that this conference seeks to have as its objectives. Well, very simply put, despite all the rosy predictions that come from Dr. Greenspan and the official proclamations from the White House that the recession is over, I am sorry to bring you the news that it is not. You do not solve economic problems by proclamation. You solve them by work. You solve them by cooperation between the elements of our economy, government, business, management, labor, finance. And you're not going to solve them simply because a member of Congress thinks they're over, or the president thinks it's through, or a distinguished gentleman like Dr. Greenspan says that he thinks that we bottomed out in the recovery, but he's not sure, but at the same time, he doesn't see much chance for any relief from unemployment. That's a fine way to bottom out. I think it's maybe better to say bottoms up than bottoms out in those circumstances. Now, when I first came to the Senate in 1949, this nation had as its employment goal a 2% maximum of unemployment. That's what we thought was a stable type of economy that provided work opportunities for our people. Gradually, that objective has been eroded, so that it went up from 3% and then to 4%, and then in the early 1970s, the White House and the Council of Economic Advisors and others tell us that 5% was a reasonable unemployment level. But that's not all. Now we're being told that at least between now and the end of this decade that you shouldn't expect much less or much better than a 6% or possibly even a 7% unemployment level. And it may even be more severe than that. The important thing that I want to emphasize here is that you are being conditioned to accept that figure. You are being conditioned, when I say you, the American people are being conditioned to accept 5, 6, 7, or whatever percentage point you wish as a description of full employment, rather than being conditioned to accept the kind of remedies that are necessary to put this country back on the economic track of full employment. Full employment is not 5% unemployment. Full employment is not 6 and 7% unemployment. And I don't care how many intelligent people that say they know economics and production and management continue to tell us that these figures are acceptable. I'm here to tell you that they are not acceptable. Such figures are not acceptable economically, politically, morally, or any other way. I can't imagine that as we approach the 200th anniversary of our republic, we celebrate those words of life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Not only those words, but those commitments and those what we call inalienable natural rights, that we're willing to say that pursuit of happiness for this country is a high level of unemployment for millions of people that want to work, that are able to work, that can work and ought to work. I remind you of what a great English philosopher once said, John Stuart Mill. He said, let a man have nothing to do for his country, and he shall have no love for it. Now, the quality of patriotism that this country needs to nourish is the participation of its people in its life, not the participation of people on the sidelines, but in the volley of action that is here, or the valley of action that is here all the time. And when I see leaders, elected leaders, appointed leaders, self-styled leaders, telling us that we just have to sort of get used to these rates of unemployment, I say to you that they erode the patriotism that this country needs. You cannot expect young men and women who are citizens of this republic, living in our cities, and particularly in our inner cities, to be denied a chance to participate in the production of goods and services of this nation, and still to be in love with America. It just won't work. So if for no other reason, if you just put aside the economics for a while, if for no other reason other than just to be true to our heritage, to be true to the meaning of the bicentennial, we ought to be launching a major endeavor to put people back on their jobs, and not only on the jobs they held, but millions of new jobs for young people who have never had a work experience in their lives, to deny people the chance to produce, to share in responsibility, is to deny them really liberty and life. So I'm here to ask you not to be great economists. We have them in our midst. We know pretty well what the problem is. What we're really here for is to organize for political action. And I'm talking about the kind of action that will see to it that the mind of the American people, the public mind, is open to the necessity of doing better than we've done thus far. You know, that's the whole thing that we need to keep in mind, to do better. I've had many people say to me, particularly in recent days, you know, they wonder what I'm going to do and all this. And I say, well, I'll tell you what I'd like to do. I'd just do better. And I believe that's what we ought to all try to do, just to do better. The 9.2% official rate of unemployment for May would have been unimaginable 5 years ago, 10 years ago, or 15 years ago. And yet it is pronounced, and the government goes right along. And I might add that even seems to go rocking along in Congress too a little bit. The government goes right along pretending like it didn't exist. But the real truth is that these averages mean nothing. It's like talking about the common man, or, you know, the medium income, or median income. People out my way sometimes ask me what you mean by that. But there is nothing that is general. Everything is specific. When you break it down, this figure 9.2, you see that it masks greater hardship experienced by many of our fellow Americans. Black unemployment rate for adults, 14.7. Among teenagers, joblessness is 21.8. And amongst black teenagers, it is the incredible 39.9%, 40% or over. Now, no self-respecting citizen of this country, in or out of office, can tolerate that kind of economic disaster for so many people, particularly for young people. I had the privilege not long ago of addressing the National Conference on Crime and Delinquency, which held its 34th meeting out in my city of Minneapolis. And I made note of the fact that three national surveys have been taken that relate the rise of crime to the rise of unemployment. And the increase in the population of prisons, not due to better law enforcement, my dear friends, but to the rise of joblessness in this nation. And the first figures to come in were in the state of Michigan, where the city of Detroit, suffering a major catastrophe, saw its unemployment rates rise up into 20% or more, and saw the rate of crime, particularly property crime, going up and up and up. Isn't it interesting that, as one of the witnesses testifying, I think it was Mayor Coleman Young the other day before the Joint Economic Committee, he said, you know, when they had a terrible tornado out in Ohio, the whole nation was rallied to do something about that disaster, and rightly so, rightly so. Years ago, there was a terrible explosion down in Texas City in Texas. And the whole country was asked by the president and others to help in a great act of generosity. We have acts of nature in the rural areas of America, and we pass special legislation to provide economic assistance for people that have been flooded out or crops that have been burned out and so forth. But here we are in our cities, the cities that are the home of whom today, mainly? The home of the poor, the needy, the ethnic groups, and the elderly. That's where most of them live. And they are in tragic circumstances, these cities. There are people, vast numbers of them, without work and even without hope. And somehow or another, we say, well, this is the way the system works. This is what we have to expect, and nothing will be done about it. I just had the Joint Economic Committee take a survey of some of our leading cities. And let me just release to you now what we found. Our survey, which included 18 major American cities, clearly indicates that urban America is in an employment depression. Now, it seems to be lost on far too many. For example, our survey shows that the unemployment within the city limits of Detroit is 20.9. It is actually, I believe, slightly higher from what I saw in the official statistics of that city. 18.3 in Providence, Rhode Island. 16.6 in Newark, New Jersey. 13.4 in Boston. 13% in Cleveland. 12.3% in Atlanta. About 14%, as I recollect, in New York City. And the list goes on and on and on, and it shows a pattern that there are islands of depression in America where millions of people live. And these islands of depression are afflicted not only with unemployment, but with every conceivable problem. Shortage of revenue to take care of the essential social services for people that are employed or unemployed. A general breakdown in the sense of community spirit. A rise in crime and lawlessness, and a host of social ills. And we have been contenting ourselves by getting figures of what we call metropolitan areas, for example. If you take the 21% unemployment rate in Detroit and spread it out over enough of a metropolitan area, you can get it down to about 13%. And then they say, look, isn't that remarkable? Ladies and gentlemen, to play with figures like this is to play with people's lives. Because unemployment is not just a statistic, as everybody in this audience knows. Unemployment is a personal tragedy. It is being told you're not needed. It is a man having to look at himself, or a wife that is a breadwinner in the family, having to wake up and say, there's nothing for me to do, nobody wants me, no one needs me. It's your kids asking you, what's up? And what it really means is a breakdown in the social structure of our country. Therefore, I tell you that it is a social, economic, and moral outrage. And until we feel that way, nothing will be done about it. As long as we leave it to statisticians, nothing will be done. You have to feel it in your gut, and then something will be done. Now, we are not alone in this world as an industrialized country. There are other countries that have high productivity, substantial gross national product. They experience inflation, and they have had more problems with oil than we've had. The Western European countries depend upon the importation of fuel to about 75% of their total requirements, or 80%. And yet, the other day, I noticed that the president of France declared a national emergency when the unemployment rate rose above 4.5%. In Great Britain and Italy, unemployment is 3.5%. Their inflation is incredible, but their unemployment rate is down. And Japan, it is below 3%. I don't want to burden you with just the commentary on the Federal Republic of Germany, but here it is, a powerful nation industrially. Its inflation rate is half of ours. Its unemployment rate is half ours. Its Deutschmark is the superior currency of the world. And they didn't mind having the Bundesbank, which is the central bank of the Federal Republic of Germany, announce that they would have an increase in the money supply of 8%. If you can get the Federal Reserve Board to do that in America, it would be a major breakthrough. And I add quickly that if you're discussing, and you are, you're concerned about the rates of unemployment, that it'll do very little good just to scold the President or the Congress, or to ask the President or the Congress to do this or that, unless the Federal Reserve System of this country joins the team. There is no way that we are going to be able to design economic policies that will put this country back into a path of economic growth and the reduction of unemployment as long as the Federal Reserve System feels that it is outside of the influence of the Declaration of National Goals and Priorities. It's my judgment that we should be having members of the Federal Reserve Board before a conference like this, citizens of the United States, and you should be asking them, what are you doing to fulfill the objectives of the Employment Act of 1946? Because that Employment Act of 1946 calls upon the Congress and the President and all institutions of government, including the Federal Reserve, may I say, to adopt such policies as to assure maximum production, maximum employment, and maximum income. You've heard me say before, as I said before, the conference, the so-called summer conference last September, that this government has been in open violation of that law. If any private citizen were in violation of a law of that consequence, all the enforcement agencies of this government would be on their back. But the Congress of the United States and the 1946 to be ignored as if it never were written, as if somehow or another it was an advisory opinion. Try that on the IRS sometime. Ladies and gentlemen, I think this is why we need to know a whole lot more about the laws that we have enacted and a whole lot more about how they are being fulfilled. Now, the President, we know about his veto, and we know that the Congress sustained that veto of an emergency employment bill, which would have, believe it or not, with all of its inadequacies, created at least 1 million jobs. I don't want that to be forgotten. At the very same time, the President says that this is inflationary, he's asking for a 25% increase in the budget of the Defense Department, without any regard as to whether or not there was any consistency between the two messages. The reason given, of course, was of inflation. But the President didn't tell us anything in that veto message about better enforcement of our antitrust laws. He didn't say anything about that he was going to investigate the administered price structure that seems to permeate our economy and bring on inflation and problems to millions of Americans. No, the whole thing is, if you don't know it, the recession is over. Nobody hopes it is more than I. I'm a son of the Depression. I remember it all too vividly. And thank God that we've built into our economy what we call stabilizers, that at least can hold back the possibility of a massive depression. No one should get any encouragement out of even talking about the possibilities of a major depression. But I do not want the lingering fever, or should I put it this way, the lingering pain and disease of recession. I'm here to tell you that unemployment is our economic Vietnam. It gnaws at us, it divides us, it causes bitterness, it destroys faith in the structure of this country, economic and political. And just as it could be ignored for a while, as Vietnam was, I remind you that it will ultimately tear us apart unless we can come to grips with it. We cannot satisfy ourselves merely on gross national product. Gross national product for what? Gross national product for whom? You can have a tremendous increase in gross national product and still have 5-10% of your people outside of the whole program, outside of all of the action that's taking place. America cannot afford to content itself with just increased production. We need what the law says, maximum production, but also maximum income for our people and maximum employment. But we're being conned again, and don't you forget it. Every day, subtly, day after day, you're being told things are better. And things may be better. Profits may be better. Production may be better. But I'm telling you, the lives of millions of our people are not better. And that's what this is all about. This country is made for people. It starts out that way. We the people. Not we the GNP. Not we the profits. Not even we those that are at work. But we the people. And I have a continuing feeling that even those of us who speak as I do are sometimes a little less than vigilant and not sufficiently militant about the problems of our economy. The president said, you know, that unemployment is the biggest concern of the 8.2% of the American workers temporarily out of work. When he said a month later, 2 months later, it had gone up to 9.3, but he had, for starters, for openers, he said 8.2. But he said inflation is the universal enemy of 100% of our people in America today. Well, ladies and gentlemen, no one denies that inflation is a silent tax. It's a hidden tax on the income of everyone. But merely to say that unemployment affects only those that are out of work and that inflation affects everyone is surely not to reveal any knowledge of economics or the economy. It is simply, may I say, to show a simplistic attitude that it cannot be condoned in this country. And I take issue with it. We estimate in our studies in the Joint Economic Committee that 75 million Americans, now listen to this figure, will experience the unemployment of at least one member of their families during 1975. And at any one time, over a period of time, there will be, if aggregate put together during a year, some 26 million people that will have been without jobs. So it isn't that there's just 8.5 million people without work. First of all, 9.3 is not an accurate figure. You know it and I know it. There are the underemployed, some 3 million, that want full-time work, half-time workers, part-time. There's another 1.25 million that just dropped out of the labor market. You know all of that. But be that as it may, I think what's important for us to know is the tragic loss that comes to millions of families. It is like a casualty, an economic casualty in the households of millions of Americans. In the face of these grim statistics, the administration's response, and I have to say it here with great reluctance, I don't think we've done nearly enough in the Congress, has been to go slowly, and we've been told that we must accept a gradual return to full employment. It's sort of like the way the old 18th century doctor cured the fever. Bleed the patient. I've said that they should put a barber pole out in front of the White House so we know what they were really thinking about. Now let's just take a look at this gradual approach. It's easy for people who are at work on jobs that pay $40,000 a year, $35,000 a year, to say we ought to take the gradual approach. I had a gentleman jump me not long ago up in the city of Duluth about this whole subject of unemployment. I said, well, let's just answer it this way. If you were one of the 9.2% of the unemployed, how would you feel about it? He said, well, I hadn't given it any thought on that basis. And that's a part of the problem here. What does unemployment mean at the gradual approach? It means about 6% to 7% for the next 4 years. It means $1.5 trillion in lost output by the government's own estimate between now and 1980. You talk about waste, the waste of human resources, the waste of lost production. $1.5 trillion on which no revenues will be collected. No family will be fed. No jobs will be given. But $1.5 trillion flushed down the Potomac, so to speak, out to sea. Even if you had unemployment at a full unemployment statistic of 4% of our people unemployed, it means lower incomes, lower tax revenues, lower profits, and ultimately lower wages. I'm as concerned as the president is about inflation. However, I submit he does not seem to understand that the only protection against inflation for most Americans is a decent, well-paying job. That's what I'm telling you. The notion that we can control inflation only by imposing long periods of idleness and high unemployment on millions and millions of our citizens is outdated, it is ridiculous, and it is tragically misguided. And we cannot accept it. I don't need to give you the lecture here today on the way in which jobs could be created. I ask for your counsel, however. Every senator that will appear here, every congressman will need your counsel and advice. Certainly we need to study more about the better ways of providing job opportunities to our people. Surely we ought to be concerned about the fact that in the 1960s, 10 million of our fellow Americans worked their way out of poverty, and those 10 million have all fallen back. all falling back into the pit of poverty once again. We need to look much more carefully at the techniques used by other nations to bring all of their citizens into the labor market. We need to analyze our own experience much more carefully and draw from it conclusions that can provide the basis for better programs in the future. We need to consider the techniques that can be used to encourage the private sector to increase job opportunities. This is important work, nothing more important, work that must be done in Congress, work on which we need your guidance. But in our efforts, we must continuously remind ourselves and the public that a federal commitment to full employment would not mean a proliferation of leaf-raking projects. That's what they say the minute that Humphrey comes up with his full employment bill or Augustus Hawkins comes up with his. They say, there they go again. Well, I want to tell you something. As much as I abhor leaf-raking, I think it's better than letting people sit idle and rot. Much better. I'm not advocating. I'd rather pay a person twice, three times what they get on unemployment compensation and have them at work doing something that's good for the country, doing something that's good for themselves. And surely we got enough imagination, a country that can do what we've done, a nation that thinks that it can do almost anything. We ought to be able to find ways and means of finding job opportunities for people in better things than just breaking leaves. So what we need to do is to take a look at some of the unmet needs. They're here. Now people say right away, there he goes. No regard for the budget. I have a regard for the budget. Every 1% increase in unemployment costs this country $20 billion. $20 billion in loss, not in income, but in lost revenues to the federal government and in social services that have to be provided for the unemployed. Had we started 6 months ago with a $40 billion program, we would have been ahead right now, and we would have had money in the bank, and we would have had an unemployment rate that's substantially lower than we have today. Because since the president himself made his little speech of 8.2, which was sometime in April, it's gone up more than another percent. And Mr. President's own wisdom and his own program has cost this country $25 billion. $25 billion in unemployment compensation benefits paid out and in welfare costs. I'm an old-fashioned fellow in many ways. I believe in work. And I believe in seeing that people have a chance for work. I believe in many options for work, varieties of jobs. And we ought to be able to find it. How many thousands of new jobs could be created if we really went to work to meet our nation's housing needs? I don't know what's going to happen on our housing legislation. But this much I do know, that this country needs a national housing policy. We are a bunch of hypocrites to talk about family life, talk about the family institution, and have an economic system of high interest rates and tight credit that makes it impossible for a young man and woman that are starting a family to have a decent home in which to live. We're not talking about a palace. We're talking about a home. And let me tell you, dear friends, the American people understand this. I'll never forget when George Meany reminded the whole nation that we had an export-import bank that made money available to everybody in the world that wanted to buy any certain types of American products, and you could get it at concessional interest rates. Now, I don't have anything against the Afghans, and I don't have anything against the Brazilians. And I'm glad that they can buy a 747 or some high technology at 6% and 7% interest under the export-import bank. But I'll tell you something, if I've got a choice between an Afghan and a Brazilian and somebody in Minnesota, I come down for the Minnesotans, just four square. I think they're entitled to it. Let me tell you, until you start being more demanding about it, it's not going to happen. Because I've been with you all before. A lot of us are pretty tired around here. We've been at all these do-gooder conferences before, all of us. And they know that we've been there, and they know that when we're through with it, we don't do anything about it. And I just want to know whether or not you think we ought to have a 6% housing money. I think so, and not more than 7%. I think we ought to be able to have it. Young folks in this audience, and I got two houses now, nobody in them. When I needed a home was when we had four kids and neighbors. That's when I needed it. We really have to sense the whole housing program's upside down. We ought to have a program in this country so a young married couple can start out with a housing program and not pay anything for the first 4 or 5 years. Give them a chance to get started. Give them a chance to get started. We do this with other people. How many people could we usefully put to work if we truly attempted to provide quality health care to all of our citizens? Who can estimate the tremendous need for trained workers to man the nation's daycare centers if we get them? Who can fail to understand the need for more teachers' assistants and counselors in our education system? Instead, you know what we do? We report every week that children can't read. Now take care of them. We are reporting
its own state. That's where you start. Secondly, I did say something else. I said, I think that he will, by the very strength that he possesses, that he has, he's going to compel, hopefully, these other Democrats to come out and talk about something. And talk about the kinds of things that need to be done. Well, we haven't had a good speech of these Democratic candidates. It's at least been reported on what's really transpiring in this employment market. I'm not just talking about some poor black kid up in our New York. By the way, I happen to think the new form of racism is the neglect of our cities, and I've said so all over this country. But, But Wallace is going to compel these candidates to speak out on issues of finance, taxation, and employment, and national planning, and health. He may very well be serving a useful function. It used to be, like we used to say, that if, I remember one writer said, what would we do if the communists went away? Because every time we did something, needed to do something for education or something, we'd say, if we don't do it, the communists will get us. In this instance, I think you're going to have people that are going to know that they're not going to win unless they can meet Wallace on the issues, to show that they got a better idea, a better program, a better grasp of the situation. Otherwise, Wallace's rhetoric, Wallace's approach will take him a long way. However, I do not think he's got a chance to get out. I don't think he has. He has a built-in reflex group. It's like Fulton K. Lewis, or Fulton Lewis Jr. I remember when he used to get on the radio. You could always expect from my state about 12,000 letters, just automatic. He had that many people that were ready to write, do anything he asked them to, but it never varied. In Wallace's situation, I think he has a group that are with him. Now, he can pick up more unless the other guys and the other people come up with ideas. I don't want to see the Democrats try to make a martyr of him. I think that's going to hurt us more than help us. But let him take the battle to him. Right? Point head on. He's never had to discuss in a debate tax policy. He just says that taxes are too high. He's never had to discuss what kind of health policy he wants for this country. Let's find out what he wants. Enough of Mr. Wallace. Generalities. There is enough brain power in that conference to come out with solid, constructive proposals and put the price tag on it. People need to know what it's going to cost. They need to know what it costs to do it and what it costs not to do it, so that we have alternatives for people. No, I don't think it's. I think that the interesting thing is it's so subtle in the sense that it hasn't become what you call articulated. But it's not only a racism, it's kind of a socialist caste system they're talking about. A social caste system. Who's in the big cities that are in trouble? Who are the people that are in trouble, as they say? What's the trouble up in New York? Well, it's the poor people. It's the Puerto Ricans. It's the blacks. It's the old people. It's the welfare people, and it's the kids. Well, who's left over? The people that went to the suburbs. So you've lost your tax base in part, but more importantly, the city has become the receptacle for the social problems of the nation.
Mr. Mace isn't going to get that attitude.
Like Wallace? I doubt it.
A legitimate, honorable man would get defeated by it, or he couldn't fight it.
No, I do not think so. I tell you what I think. I think that since Watergate, there is a sense of decency in this country, a sense to do right, that if it's properly appealed to, it can do wonders. Everybody was so discouraged, disgusted, and disillusioned with what's happened in what we call all of Watergate, the whole political business, that what they're looking for today is someone who will call the shots as they see them, and somebody that will really show an interest in people. Not necessarily just being nice. For example, when I talk about jobs, I'm not talking about welfare. I mean, people ought to go to work. I've been doing some work. I think they need to be supervised. I think there needs to be plans. I think there needs to be work. I think there needs to be supervision. And people buy that because they know there are things that need to be done. So we're going to have a generation of kids, primarily ethnic blacks, Puerto Ricans, Indians, never had a job in life, never known what it was. They're going to be 25 years old, never had a full year, never once ever had a year's employment. And if you do that in this country, you're just putting a cancer, what you think is a controllable tumor, in your body politic. This is, I'd go up and say this same thing to bankers. I tell them, look, you fellas, you got more to lose than anybody. I spoke up here to the Chamber of Commerce on this the same line that I'm talking about. I can't have a new speech for everybody on this business.
Can we quote you?
Yes, you can. Not a new theme. I might have to have a new speech.
Bad theme.
It's the difference between the basic old difference from the days of Roosevelt on up to now. Republican approach. They haven't changed one damn bit. The only difference is our crowd is beginning to change a little bit. The old Hooverites and the old Republicans always believed in trickle-down economics. That's what they mean. GNP, productivity. Ultimately, this will help the people. Ultimately, you know? Nobody ever thought, well, now, if the people get going and are at work, ultimately, it'll help the people on top. That's the difference between trickleators and percolators. You know, I've said this all along, and I make no bones about it, that I just happen to be my daddy taught me that we're no better than the customer that walks in our store. And I believe that a lot of the so-called conservative business people understand this better than they're given credit for. We're getting business people today that are interested in economic planning, that are beginning to show a willingness to sit down and discuss how it can be done, instead of calling you a socialist or a communist or some ugly name. I think the best thing I said today, which was not in, it's just something that popped into my mind, was about GNP. It isn't how much GNP you got, it's for what and for whom. That's what it's all about. You can have a big GNP in this country by building another 25 Trident submarines. Or by getting another 300 B-1s. But what kind of GNP? What, for what and for whom? And that is what we haven't been thinking about. We haven't been giving this the kind of thought. And as Democrats and as so-called liberal, end quote, whatever that means these days, there just isn't the kind of what I call social thinking.
Well, where are the liberals today? What is the liberals?
I don't know. I'll tell you one thing, that you're not going to out-conservative the conservatives. I mean, that's one thing you can't do. And if you start to join with them in order to purify your politics, you don't gain anything and you lose something. You get confused. I sit in the Democratic caucus, Jimmy, and I hear more worries about the federal deficit than I hear almost any place else, but they don't there isn't enough worry about what's happening to the individual deficits. There's a lack of understanding today as to the nature of this new economy. We've got a corporate economy, a highly organized economy, but not organized by many people, but by a few people. They make the decisions. The grain companies decide what your export policies will be. A half a dozen of them. The steel companies decide what price you're going to pay for steel. Three automobile companies decide what you're going to have for an automobile. And basically decide what you're going to have with a handful of oil companies, decide what you're going to have for oil policy. And that's what's wrong up here in Congress, that we have not equipped ourselves either by training, background, or staff to meet them head on and say, wait a minute. This isn't the way it's going to be. Or at least I want you to listen to my point of view, and I'm willing to listen to yours. And I don't think it'll get done until you elect a new president. I must say that this government is highly executive. The Constitution places great power in the presidency of the United States. And until we get somebody in there that can bring in the kind of thinking that is needed to give some sense of direction in this country, it's not going to happen. 535 members up here with a lot of good ideas, and the Congress has a lot of brilliant men in it, hardworking people, and it ought not to be demeaned. But it's almost impossible to get a program, a sense of direction out of Congress that has any precision to it, you know, any cutting edge, because you have to compromise so much along the way, unless you've got a president that's ramming it through and that says, I won't take this, and you fellas are going to take this. What we've got today is a president that says, boys, it isn't sufficiently ambiguous. You know, you can still cut melted butter with this knife. He doesn't want it. But there's so much vitality left in the country. I mean, there's a lot of decency left in this country. There's a tremendous amount of energy. I censor Jimmy wherever I go. I really do. People can and are appealed. They can be appealed to. And they will do the right thing. But somebody's got to blow the bugle. You know, the Sermon on the Mount, it was on the Mount, you know, and it was one sermon. They didn't have people all shouting down in the valley. It was the Sermon on the Mount. And it was Moses that got up there on that big hilltop, you know. Somebody has got to stand up and be the leader. Not the leader that abuses power, but a leader that understands that power comes from the people. Just imagine what we could do today if we could pick up that telephone and call the White House and say, look, we're trying to figure out 10 or 5 new initiatives in the employment area. We need the best talent that you've got over there. We need the people from Commerce and Labor and Joint and from the Council of Economic Advisors to get it done.
But we got one mountain. And that mountain's controlled by somebody who doesn't say the right things.
We're up on the hill up here, but they're, you know.
Yeah, we're on the hill and he's on the mountain, and that's about a good analogy. The media focuses on that mountain all the time.
But are we ready?
Yep.
Thanks,
Perry.
Thank you, dear.
No line listing. Bye bye. Thank you.
This is great.
This is good. I'm walking.
Thank you.
had going on.
Who's talking to you? Did you say something to me?
I said, you must have enjoyed that one. He's one of your kind.
Could you?
I told him I could check that thing out and he said he's not interested in getting off the street, but maybe I could go to the street together. If it looks all right.
And had he snapped out of it or did he go belching away? What's his problem?
Of course he had 3 days when he was just lying down in
the house. Yeah, this morning. And I thought he was laying down here and she was right for about 3 or 4 minutes. He said, what is it? And he was still walking on the stairs and walking out of the room. I mean, like 4 minutes, 2 days, don't give me this.